This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Brian Koberger is in prison. But what we've just learned from newly unsealed documents changes how we understand the case entirely. He didn't just commit a horrific crime, he built up to it. Surveillance of the victim's house weeks before the murders. A break-in in Pullman a year earlier with eerie similarities, but was it him? And a glove box containing women's ID cards. Disturbing Tinder chats, police scanner searches hours before the attack, and chilling silence ever since. This was not random. It was methodical, and it was missed. Joining us now is psychotherapist and author Siobhan Scott. She's author of this, of a few books, The Mind of Mass Killers, here to unpack what these new revelations teach us about how Koberger did this, who he was before the murders, and how a system built to detect threats let this one slip on through. So, Siobhan, I mean, let's start right there. I mean, based on, you know, your research into mass killers, what does Koberger's pattern here of surveillance and control suggest about his psychological profile leading up to the murders itself?
Yeah, none of this newly revealed information surprises me at all. In fact, it's exactly the MO of a sexual domination serial killer. Mm-hmm. So I would have been surprised if this kind of stuff wasn't going on. And it's very common. These guys are fantasy driven, and there's always a buildup. I mean, they never commit a murder like this just, oh, get up one day and I'm going to get a big knife and go kill people. It's always years of these kinds of bizarre fantasies about sexual violence. And the stalking, surveillance, that's also classic, because if you have somebody who's obsessive, methodical, doesn't want to get caught, going into this with a lot of rehearsal, they want to understand their target, their victim, and they do their homework, they do their research. It's also, as far as the burglary, they often commit practice crimes before then. So,
and we're going to get into that in just a little bit. I want to talk about what's something that struck me here, the fantasy driven. Because when you look at a large chunk of the young male population going right into adulthood, they seem to live in a fantasy land, a lot of it driven by video games. Not everyone, but I'd say a hell of a lot higher number than there used to be. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a fantasy life or having, you know, in a healthy sort of way with clear boundaries and understanding the difference between reality and fantasy. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on that. And I don't know what Koberger's video game habits were, and I'm not trying to blame video games, but my point here being is there's a lot of young men that seem to have and live in somewhat of a fantasy land, and that's been exposed to time and time again once these people get caught. Another one I'm thinking of is Maddie Soto's murderer, Stefan Stearns. He was really big into fantasy stuff, talked about it like he was 12, basically, when he spoke to his mom, even after the murders. He's into this, he's into that. I got this card, I got that card. Is this a problem in the way that we're allowing these young men to be brought up in this country, where fantasy becomes just a little too close to reality? And then for some of them, there really is no boundary between the two?
That's an interesting supposition. I can't say we have any data on that at this point. The internet and the, you know, video games, the way they're immersive, the way they are now, this is all relatively new. And so we're still probably just in the early phases of observing our brains changing from the immersion in virtual worlds. We can definitely say that it causes people who are highly immersed in the virtual world, whether it's video games or, you know, chat rooms or other kinds of things, that they're disengaged more from real life activities and from social activities and physical activities because they're isolated in their bedrooms all the time. And that is not particularly good for people. We know that having a well-connected real life social life is protective psychologically. Mm-hmm. The other concern that I have is how I see tremendous problems with what you could call porn addiction with mm-hmm. young men. And that troubles me because, you know, I'll see in therapy 30, 35-year-olds who've never gone on a date with a real woman. And they're very sexually active, but it's all on porn sites. Mm-hmm. And again, then, you know, as would fit with any kind of serial killer, what kind of porn sites are they accessing? And how does this affect a developing young mind when you're talking about an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old? You know, when their sexual mapping is occurring, when they're determining their way for seeking gratification, and do they learn then how to relate to real women?
How much is AI going to make this worse? Where people can literally have any thought that they have in their mind come to reality. Because there's a lot of weird stuff out there. Stuff that is seemingly bordering on, like, fantasy of people / animal type things going on. And this is kind of going off topic of Koberger, but since we're kind of going down this road of fantasy and weird ways of thinking and normalizing in very young minds, I mean, in theory, I mean, this can also, this world can, you know, open up people, or not open up people's minds, but direct people's minds towards very dark, dark paths at very young ages that would be illegal if acted out, but can now seemingly, you know, be virtually simulated in ways that never existed before.
Yeah, I have a lot of concerns about that. There have been different programs over the years, different game-like programs focused on sexuality. There was one created in Japan that the goal of the you know, you played from first person point of view, and the goal was to rape people.
Jesus Christ.
Literally. Yeah, and that was in the title of the game. I won't say the whole title of the game, but It had the word rape in it. And that came out probably 12, 13 years ago. And I actually was doing seminars on the problematic use of video games. And that was one game that I used as an example of something that, you know, we're programming people here with this. So AI, I know ChatGPT now because I have a friend who was writing a book that had a lot of sexual themes mm-hmm. in it, and she was trying to use ChatGPT, and it would pop up and say, I am not allowed to respond to that kind of question.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they are trying to screen and filter, but what other things are in the future? It's alarming. Yeah.
We've been doing a series on the Devil's Den case, and then discovering the murderer, the alleged murderer had a history of issues with schools and allegations of predatory type behavior, and using those words. Oh my God, the amount of heck we went through with ChatGPT just to try and get answers was hellish, because it's like, bad word. It's like, in context,
exactly.
We're learning. And you say, it's a news story. Oh, okay. But yeah, I mean, and I'm glad that there are those sort of safe things in place, but they need to make sense and understand mm-hmm. what they're doing. We know that he searched the police scanner and websites before the attack. I mean, how does that fit within the behavior of someone escalating towards a mass killing when he's prepping this stuff? What would be the police scanner end of things? That's kind of, I guess you'd think it's a little bit old school to a young person, but obviously he's listening in and probably trying to look at response times and such. What's your thoughts on all that?
Yeah, looking for patterns. He did not want to be caught, mm-hmm. and he was clearly using his knowledge of the criminal justice system to his advantage, how to become a better criminal, which is scary how many people may go into this field of study with that agenda. I don't think it's most of them, but certainly some do.
Without a doubt. The ID cards were another thing that really came up here. And this is something that early on we had heard rumors about, that there were ID cards found in a glove box. It was never fully confirmed. It was kind of through channels here and there. Well, it's real. There were ID cards. And just as it was relayed back then, they weren't of the victims in the house. They were of other people, someone that he likely went to school with, actually two people that he likely had gone to school with at different points in different times. None of them seemed to have reported their card missing, or if they did, like most do, you just, well, go get a new one. You don't think it's in the glove box of someone who's going to be a homicidal maniac. But let's talk about that. The ID cards, these are people that are alive. They don't have anything to report on Koberger in terms of predatory behavior, at least not that we know of. What is going on here with that, with just having these cards, although they're not his victims?
One of my terms I go back to all the time is associational cues. And this is some kind of object. We all use associational cues, hopefully in positive ways. But, you know, when we put up a picture of our kids or our spouse on our desk, it's because it makes us have emotions that we feel close to them in response to this tangible object. And so to me, the ID cards speak of the desire to possess the object, the person, and to have a sense of control and power. And if you look at the symbology of your ID cards, there's almost this little element of, I own you, I possess you, I've got you. And certainly it fed his fantasy life, which is really troubling.
I don't think there's ever really a great excuse for having someone else's ID card in your possession in any way, shape, or form. Unless, like, here, hold this for me while I go on the water slides. Yeah. Like, that's about it. It's like, oh, I'm holding them for the water slides. They forgot them. That's not, I'm sure, what this was whatsoever. Let's go back to the fantasy life a little bit. I want to talk about that. I mean, how central is a fantasy life in the development of mass killers? I mean, not just Koberger. We don't know a ton about what was going on in that fantasy world of his. But when you dig into these people as a whole, obviously there's the fantasy, the perverse-ass fantasies that they're having. But is there a wider world of fantasy within people like this typically? One that doesn't maybe even go to the aspect of violence or horrible, horrible behavior? Is it kind of an atmosphere that they live in, and that's just one of the many facets of it?
That's a good question. And the thing that I can say we definitely know is they have fantasies of wanting to be famous. Grandiose ideas about themselves. Mm-hmm. Do they have fantasies out, you know, for a sexual domination killer? Do they have fantasies outside of the urge to be famous? And of course, their violent fantasies about murder and rape and all these other things. I don't think we have data on that. It's a good question. To what extent do they live in an alternate reality or in their own world? I think that's one we'll have to look into more.
I mean, it does make you wonder. It would make it, I guess, maybe easier to fall in and out of more extreme fantasies if you're already living at a certain level there. Koberger also allegedly sent a Tinder message asking about the worst way to die. Not exactly what I think a lot of people would be communicating through Tinder. I mean, I don't know, maybe if you get in a weird conversation or something, but this doesn't seem like it was that. More like, hey, how's your day? What's the worst way to die? You know, just kind of little out there. What does that tell you about his interactions or his skill at interacting with others through something like that?
Yeah, you could sure say that was leakage, you know, somebody who's like saying these things about their inner world that the rest of us would go, that's kind of odd, that's mm-hmm. different. But he had this quality of being very odd, but just functional enough to make it through the world for the most part, you know, whereas some people that are really mentally ill, it's mentally ill in the sense of psychotic, you know, delusional hallucinations. Everybody can spot it. They're not functional. But Koberger was functional enough, but leaking these little odd things. And yeah, whether the diagnosis of autism is the best fit, it's possible that it is. We don't know that without evaluating him. Schizoid personality, which is a person who doesn't connect normally with other people. He certainly had OCD, mm-hmm. and that's something that's still happening for him. But, Yeah, in all these qualities together, it created this very odd social style that's apparent in a text like that. And that he was very focused on death. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would you ask somebody that unless you were thinking about it a lot?
Yeah, I mean, that leakage that comes through, really, I mean, it certainly says a lot about what's going on. When he's leaking these things out in these conversations, is he aware that it's so off-putting and bizarre to the rest of the world to say that sort of stuff? Or is he like kind of fishing for another like him that maybe is into, you know, more dark ways of thinking about the world?
That's an interesting hypothesis that he's looking for a soulmate who's just like him. Yeah, could be. But I think he's probably clueless that this is going to be off-putting to people. Mm-hmm. And that's just, you know, whatever is going on with his brain that makes him a unique animal, empathy is not a part of it. The ability to sense how other people respond to us, he just doesn't get it.
You think there's more IDs out there? Do you think he, because it seemed like that was a bit of a collection he was putting there in his glove box. And it makes you wonder. I've been wondering for a while if there's a knife buried in a little cash box somewhere along his trip, because we do look at the vehicle data and it does show him stopping off at like wooded areas where I would not be surprised. And Rob and Drake and me are going to talk about that this week, about where could this weapon possibly be? And what else could be in this little, you know, as BTK would have called it, hidey hole?
Yeah.
I'm wondering how much more of that might be at play here that we are not yet aware of with Koberger, that's not going to come through these documents, but just is still out there in the ether.
Probably tons of secret items, things that he had collected throughout his adolescence years. And who knows where it all is or what's been destroyed. And of course, I'm very curious about the content of his computer and what evidence he may have kept there.
And that's a shocking thing, because the content of the computer and all of his digital devices, the shocking part, nothing. They have come back and they have said there is nothing here. They believe it was wiped, that he found a way to wipe everything off. So there's traces of that. So he was, and that's what's so interesting to me about this character, is he was very smart in some areas. Like, they believe he was literally wiping things as he went. It wasn't like okay, tonight's the night. Let's go back through history and delete everything from X date to X date. It was kind of like, as he's doing this, he's going to wipe that right after he looked at it, and so forth. He was so meticulous in some of these details. He was meticulous enough not to leave any of him behind other than the sheath. He was meticulous enough to clean his car, so much so that they described it as being disassembled. Yet he left people's IDs that were not his. I can't say victims, but people's IDs that were not his in his glove box to be found. I mean, is that just like, okay, you're really smart over here, but you're a complete idiot over here. And there's something not telling you, you better empty that glove box too. Or does he think, well, that's not valuable to anybody. I didn't kill those people. I mean, what the hell, what is going on here? Is it just like a shit, I missed that?
I think you're seeing maybe an aspect of his OCD, that he honed in on certain kinds of things. Obviously, he was very aware of DNA and blood and that kind of evidence. And he just became obsessed with certain things while being relatively clueless about other things, like the IDs in the glove box. That seems obvious. Yeah. But for whatever reason, he's got this unique brain that goes to obsessions about certain things without looking at the big picture.
With the IDs, I mean, being a form of trophy there, is that the sort of thing that kind of, you would say, maybe led him up to being able to do this? Like, does it start small? Does it start with, I'm going to take this ID from this woman and that's going to make me feel powerful or whatever the hell it makes him feel? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, oh, I got another one. Like, well, what? And it just amps up to where you end up slaughtering them one night. I mean, is that what is part of a slow build, or had he not been caught, would he just kind of been out there every once in a while grabbing IDs as well, just part of his MO?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it was part of a behavioral progression. And originally, when he first started doing things like that or monitoring people, I would guess, I'm going to guess that he was a voyeur when he was out driving around at night looking at the stars. He was probably peeping in windows, too. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a really common behavior with people like this. And, you know, they never just get up one day and go from being a normal, healthy person with a normal sex life to I'm going to commit rape, murder, and, you know, do horrible things. There's always this progression. So my guess is that there had, and probably all kinds of things that he did that were weird and creepy that we'll never know about.
Sure. Someone like a Koberger, someone like him with his issues with what we know of his dark sexual type desires. We know like what he was looking up. It was, you know, horrible things and basically focusing on doing things to unconscious women. Happened to also be in the college realm of things. So that was, this was all part of a fantasy, even though there was no SA at the scene or anything like that. Certainly, this was a crime that seems to have been built on that sort of motive. Have you ever seen any case where someone's reformed after going down a dark road like this? Maybe not killing, but someone who's like, this was my, I didn't go that far, but I went this far in my mind. Does this, I mean, if this is how your sexual fantasies are running your life and how your brain is working and what your body and mind are telling you what you like, do you, can that be reversed? Or is this one of those things where it's like, well, once a predator, always a predator?
That's a really hard question. I have seen people, certainly in institutions, you know, if I went in to just do an assessment with somebody, can they get out? Can they not get out? That kind of thing. Do they know how to talk the talk of I'm recovered from this stuff? I have seen some that do. But does that mean that if released, that they would not slide right back into it and reoffend again? Or are they just really good con artists? I don't know that I have evidence either way for that. Yeah. But certainly in forensic mental health institutions where they get lots of therapy and they attend groups. And yeah, sex offenders can supposedly learn certain skills at controlling their desires and channeling themselves in healthier ways. But certainly the earlier you catch somebody who's going down an aberrant path, like teenagers, and you can find teenage sex offenders, you know, and if they get into treatment earlier, the odds are probably better that they can be redirected and rein some of this stuff in. But I tell you, it would make me really nervous if let's say I had a neighbor who had those tendencies and then said, oh, but I went to therapy and I'm better now. I'd still keep my eye on him, you know?
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever feel comfortable with anybody like that. I mean, there are, if you look at it more like, should it be looked at more as, I mean, I'm not in any way trying to downplay this, but as more of an addiction in someone? I mean, it's horrible, abhorrent behavior, but is it really an addiction more than just really, really bad judgment? And should it be handled more in that way in terms of trying to find a place for these people to live where, I mean, there's plenty of alcoholics who don't want to drink that continue drinking. I would imagine, is that the case in the S offender world where there's people that don't want to do that, but there it's that much of an impulse, that much of an addiction?
Oh, very, very much, very much. Even, you know, I have worked with pedophiles who know what they do is terrible, but they know they can't be alone with a child.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, some of them have said, I hate myself. I wish I'd never been born. You know, I'm suicidal because of these horrible things I've done. And these were people who were not incarcerated, but they knew they had these behavioral safeguards in, I am never alone with children, even my grandchildren. And, you know, it's a scary thing because at what point is the addiction going to override that desire to not reoffend again.
And that's, yeah, that's insane. I mean, it's scary. And I mean, it's not, I mean, they know that the problem is there. They know they don't want to do it, but they won't be alone with their grandchild because their, whatever the hell that is in them, that's driving them, is stronger than their knowledge of knowing that that would destroy the life of someone you care about. Or person in general. That's
Yeah, treatment is very much similar in addiction. It's, you know, when you're early in your recovery from alcoholism, you don't go hang out in bars, you know? You don't go to parties where everybody's going to be drunk. I mean, you have to manage yourself behaviorally and avoid high-risk situations. And it's very true for sex offenders in the same way. Don't allow yourself to ever be in a situation where there's going to be temptation.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of his behaviors in jail, the obsessive cleaning that we've heard about, the social withdrawal, talking to himself, having really bizarre demands, you know, wanting vegan food only cooked in certain pans. Obviously, I think he got his vegan food, but I don't think they honored the pan request. How does that fit within like known psychological patterns of other mass killers post-crime, or does it?
I don't think it does. You know, he clearly has clinical obsessive compulsive disorder. And my guess is that these kind of rigid behaviors and the need for control over his diet and all these other kinds of things that he becomes fixated on, that this is old news for mm-hmm. him. This is how he's been probably for years. And when he's under stress, it may intensify, it may get a bit worse. And clearly being incarcerated is going to be stressful for anybody. And so there may be an amplification of these symptoms, but this is part of his OCD. And certainly you can see with serial killers that they have a lot of obsessive tendencies. You know, as you use the word addiction, they're kind of addicted to this process. But not all have clinical OCD in the way that they need these rituals and these really rigid kinds of things.
I mean, is there a level of disassociation that's going on with this? I mean, just like you just got caught murdering four people, and he knew he got caught murdering four people, and you're asking, can you not cook my vegan lasagna in the pan you cooked a beef steak in? I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. whoa, what? Mm-hmm. And there's other aspects too to this case. Just, I mean, the standing silent when he was asked to plea, and his utter lack of any emotional reaction when the victim impact statements were being read and he was being sentenced. I mean, was he present for any of that mentally, or just does it mean nothing to him?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it dissociation, which is, you know, sort of in a different category, mm-hmm. but I would say it's cold. Mm-hmm. He's in control. Why should he say anything in court? He doesn't need to. And no reaction to victim impact statements. He doesn't feel any guilt. Mm-hmm. He's not sorry. He's probably sorry he left the knife sheath there. But if this was a guy with empathy, he wouldn't have murdered four people in a brutal way like this for mm-hmm. no reason that would make sense to the rest of the world. You know, this is a guy who has no moral compass. He operates very differently in the world from the rest of us. So all these things are things I would expect.
I want to talk about his pre-crime behavior a bit, because there's a lot of it. I mean, when we're looking at the full scope of his pre-crime behavior, whether that be from the stalking of the house to the ID cards. But if we go back even further, we go back to the time where, you know, he stole his sister's cell phone and then tried to sell it for allegedly, you know, heroin money at the local mall kiosk. With that having been his action, his dad turned him in to the police for it. He got a slap on the wrist. But is there more? What, I mean, obviously, I think Koberger's parents probably did the best they could with the knowledge that they had. I don't have a lot to criticize them about. But in the future, I mean, you got that sort of thing going on with your own kid and your own household that seems to have no emotional reaction to doing something like that that hurts a close loved one, what do you do in that case as a parent or as a sibling that, okay, he did this. He doesn't seem to show any remorse for it. I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it's also like, the hell's wrong with this guy?
Yeah, you stay grounded in reality that you have a very different sort of kid. And I would tell parents, you know, when they're struggling with what's normal, what's not normal, how do I cope with this? What kind of discipline do we implement? Parents need to go to therapy, not because they're doing anything wrong or that there's anything wrong with them, but they need some professional help on how do we cope with this? Because every case is going to be unique, so there's not a formula. But definitely they did the right thing by calling law enforcement and reporting it, because you do, when your kids do something that's, you know, antisocial, it's harming someone else, they need to have consequences, and they need to have consequences both inside the family and outside of the family. And so they did the right thing. Yeah, I don't see that they did anything wrong with this guy, but there are just certain things, you know, people like this are very, very secretive. And I guarantee you his family had no idea of his dark fantasies because he didn't talk about it. He didn't let them know. And even if he, you know, if they had put him in therapy, which of course I say is always a good idea, but he wouldn't have told the therapist any of that either. Mm-hmm. So when we look at how could people intervene, it's really tough with this kind of person because of their secretiveness.
Well, and also, he's someone who consequences don't really seem to matter to him, or only certain things do. Only certain things would trigger someone like him to seemingly get some sort of reaction out of him. So stealing his sister's phone, being caught with it, I don't think he cared. Yeah. There seemed to be a lot of things that just, even if it was socially wrong and he knew it, he didn't really care, even if he was caught. So how do you get through to somebody like that? Especially, I mean, that so many parents, I think, in this situation where they get a kid that's, you know, it's out there, and I'm just the clinical term out there as I'm using, but he's just someone who can't seem to be reached, I think, is how I would think of it as a parent. I can't get through to him. I can't, no matter what, this is not working. It did seem during the testimony, during the victim impact statements, that dissing him like he was a high school freshman, you know, that didn't fit in, seemed to make an impact on him when Olivia Gonzalez went up there and just eviscerated him like a mean girl. And I thought it was wonderful because it seemed to actually strike a bit of a nerve. But other than that, I mean, these people seem to have very bizarre places where they are triggered to get a reaction that is negative and visceral that they actually feel.
Yeah, I think what you saw there is the narcissism with, you know, how dare they insult me because I really am superior over everyone else. And so you'd get a little bit of a, you know, that would feel like a sting to him. But the psychopathy, that's really a brain difference. So he's got a lot of things about him. He came out of the chute with a different kind of brain. But they really don't learn from punishment. And that's one of the key factors of the personality, is they don't feel the same fear that normal people feel, which is why they'll do these really risky things that most people would just not ever do, you know. They don't have empathy, and they don't learn from punishment. So if you're raising a psychopathic kid, man, that's tough, because all the things that work with your other kids don't work with them.
Maybe I'm wrong. I'm going to say not every psychopath turns out to go and kill or be a complete menace to society. I'm sure they leave a wake of destruction, but how do they learn then? How, if punishment doesn't make them learn, and I mean, what does tell them when something is bad and you shouldn't be doing this, that actually works and makes them not want to do it?
Some of them learn very early on that life just goes better for them when they don't break the law, and they're the people that go into politics and the legal profession, you know, they become ministers.
Well, that's comforting.
Yeah. And so, yeah, definitely not all psychopaths take the road of violence. They just don't need to, because they find ways to manipulate other people and succeed and make money without becoming violent. But yeah, it's really interesting why some seem to pick that up, that life is going to go better for me if I don't break the law, and others don't. And you can throw in, there are some probably other elements like sadism, and we see that with some people. And when you know, with mass killers, you certainly see sadistic qualities where they actually get a sense of pleasure from harming others. And I guess you could say there are psychopaths who don't really care about others, but they're not sadistic. Mm-hmm. And that's another variable. So many variables with this personality stuff. It's fascinating.
It is. And I think that's the real problem, because we like to tightly wrap a problem. Let's fix it. Let's put it right in this box, and here we go. There's the solution. And there really isn't a solution to this. I mean, if you want to go into like dystopian type society, I mean, would there ever be a way to mark this type of behavior? I mean, without some sort of infraction, you know, I mean, it's one of the things we've been talking about when we've been discussing passing the trash with educators from district to district, and things being reported but never getting to a criminal level, and it just never follows them. It never goes anywhere. I mean, should this be something more on medical radars, on doctors' radars, where, you know, we do take inventory when we go in for a checkup. Okay, you were on this, it's a very quick checkup, and a lot of it is the relying on your own self-reporting.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, if you're diagnosed of something, you know, you get this sort of a diagnosis, it's usually after something happened and you're trying to figure out what's going on. But should there be more that we do in terms of looking and understanding people psychologically, just as we do physically, to, you know, parse out these sort of things earlier on and identify if they're actually there, and then take routes of, okay, this is how this person thinks, this is how we should help them navigate life, and hopefully they won't go into the serial killer route, but they're pretty apt to if we don't do something. Should there be more of that, just notating from actual professionals, not because of a police visit or a CPS report, just on your checkup? Let's dig into this deeper. Obviously, it costs money. There's a lot of things that would prevent it. But I would think that maybe we could get a better grasp on our society in terms of our mental health if there was a little more concern there.
It's a really hard call, you know, if we use Koberger as a case study. Let's say he really fits the criteria for autism. That fits millions and millions and millions of people now. And, you know, we do a pretty good job at screening for that, for neurodivergence? I think certainly pediatricians look for it now. Mm-hmm. But were there any signs? Were there signs of OCD? Yes, but that fits millions and millions of people too.
Yeah, like you gotta keep digging. Like we have our surface level, like it's autism, it's a spectrum, it covers in everything, you know, and then, okay, well, we got the OCD. Okay, that's still fairly surface level when we're talking about how deep this goes. I guess my point is, do we need to find a way to dig deeper into this? And I'm wondering if technology will help us find ways of doing this more than just the doctor's got his pad or he's just typing on the, what's going on here? Okay, I got my next one in 5 minutes. I got to get you in and out. You know, I'm just wondering if we're going to have ways to detect this sort of thing, maybe through some sort of AI that can see things and understand things and little minute things that the average doctor just doesn't pick up on because they're doing 50 other things.
I don't see any way a doctor could. I mean, you know, they've got 15 minutes, preferably 10, you know, and they're going to hit the big milestones.
Yeah.
And do they even have time to screen? This was something I was reading in a medical journal this week. Do they have time to really screen every teenager they see for substance abuse? And we're saying they need to do that. And it's like, do they have time to go into their sexuality? And are they having sex? And are they using protection? I mean, I mean, you'd need a 2-hour doctor appointment, yeah, you know, would. To do that yeah, kind of deep assessment. And what are their sexual fantasies, which they're not going to talk about, mm-hmm. even if asked. So sure. I don't see any practical way that we can do more in the healthcare system other than look for, you know, one of the big red flags for people who are psychopathic is as children, do they hurt animals? Mm-hmm. And so if a parent came in saying my kid has this kind of behavioral problem, I would think even at this point, they're going to get referred to a therapist by a medical doctor. And then a therapist is hopefully going to tune in more on these other areas of concern. And is this a kid we need to watch more closely? But yeah, I think we're a long way away from scanning everybody's brain yeah. in childhood, you know, and there are brain differences in psychopaths that can be observed. Mm-hmm. I think the research is still fairly young on this, mm-hmm. but there are speculations about the brain differences that can be seen on fMRI.
Yeah.
But that's not something, I think the civil rights people would be all over it if you're trying to say, we're going to take everybody and scan your brains now.
Yeah,
you know,
I know, it's insane. Yeah, but it's like, yeah. what, we do seem to have some ways that we could do it, but it would violate some privacy rights, and it would change. It would change the way we do some things. The same as it would change some things if mandatory reporting actually meant mandatory reporting. Mm-hmm. It would function better. But there's always, you know, there's always the reasons. There's always the things that would put a hindrance to any of those things following through. And they're logical. They're valid. At the end of the day, we're dealing with every human being who is dramatically different and yeah. trying to keep the bad ones out of the good flock.
It's hard. And it when is. You look at like the Devil's Den case, I mean, I'm sure there were people, I would guess, in the school system where there were complaints about him that would like to have mm-hmm. been able to pass that information on, but they were prohibited mm-hmm. by legal restraints on yeah. how much they can share. I know one of the government systems I used to work in that when they were screening new applicants, they could ask like one or two questions, and that's all they were allowed to ask. They weren't allowed to ask any further background information, which is unfortunate because I think there were people that got in as employees that probably should have been screened out,
yeah.
but there were all these legal requirements about how much information they could request.
And they know how to work those systems. They know how to just mm-hmm. get far enough to either check the box if they want it checked or not have it checked and mm-hmm. and keep on moving. And that's been the way they've survived for so long. Siobhan Scott, The Mind of Mass Killers. Check it out wherever you get books. Thank you, as always, for coming on and giving us your insight on this and the many cases we cover here.
Thank you.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.